I will join you afterwards with the Q&A.
Great. Okay. Hi, everyone. Good morning. Thank you so much for having me here in your beautiful Kufstein. It was just, it's really feels like such a privilege to be here. And I'm really looking forward to learning from all of you. When Verena and I were talking about this presentation, we decided this would be more academic. So I really hope that I don't bore you. If I am, please jump in and interrupt me. As we'll talk about a lot today, festivals are all should be about spontaneity. So I hope it's not too much of an academic lecture. But I hope also that what I tell you about here gives you some history, a kind of framework for understanding some of the more practical issues that we'll talk about in the interactive session in the afternoon. Just before I get going, I wanted to say a big thank you to Professor Verena Teitzel for inviting me. As you'll hear about in this talk, often Africa is marginalized from global discussions and just left out of the picture completely. So I feel like this was a very important symbolic move for you to invite someone who specializes on Africa, and that really means so much to me. And thank you very much to Imke Grimme as well for all the support of the Goethe Institute, which is doing amazing things in Africa and many African countries that I can't get into in the talk today. I'll be very critical of the French government, as you'll hear in my talk, but I just want to say I think the Germans are doing, they're really using a lot of the sort of problems from the colonial background and really changing things around. So we could talk a little bit about that in the afternoon as well. Just a sort of technical issue. I'm using Prezi for the first time in my presentation today, inspired by my own students in London. After giving lots of PowerPoint presentations, they came with these sort of fabulous dynamic Prezi presentations, and I felt very old-fashioned and very old. So this is the first time that I'm trying to use it. Please, apologies if there's some problems with it or it looks a bit bizarre, but I'm trying to stay with the times. So. So why a focus on Africa in this talk? And I just wanted to know, so I have a sense from you, who here has been to an African country? Okay, and who's been to more than one African country? Okay, a couple of you. Okay, so that's good to know. Some of you have an experience of Africa, but for some of you who haven't been there, you might be thinking, what can we really learn about that continent? You may not know that much about it. So what I hope to reveal through this talk then is what a focus on African film and its relationship to film festivals can teach all of us, not just Africans and Africanists like myself. So the examples might seem quite specific, but I'm trying to see how it can lead into broader discussions. Many scholars and practitioners do argue that Africa is often treated as an exception to the rest of the world, not simply exoticized or orientalized as the way that the Middle East or Asia might be in our Western discourses, but actually treated as though it was a different planet and Africans is not quite human. As Jean-Francois Bayard points out, Africa south of the Sahara is often said to be the limbo of the international system, existing only at the outer limits of the planet which we inhabit. Now, I've been, in addition to, as Verena said, I've been running, practically founding and running African film festivals, but I also decided to write a book on this topic. So for the past 15 years, I've been traveling to different parts of the world and looking at African film and film festivals, and looking particularly at the positioning and the framing of African films at these events. And I have to say that I found many, many examples of this marginalization of Africa at the festivals I was studying. And a very stark visual example came for me at the 2010 International Film Festival of Rotterdam in the Netherlands, which held the largest program of African cinema that an international film festival had ever held, with about 120 films. And they called this program, ironically, tongue-in-cheek, Where is Africa? The aim of it was to really question and critique Africa's marginalization from the international film festival circuit. But as you can see here, the visual symbolism used throughout this program ended up actually reinforcing that idea of marginalization. So this was a big rotating globe that was beamed up on the screen before every African film, and this sort of globe moved back and forth. And there you can see Africa is, a black continent again with a big question mark on top of it. So it was very problematic in this way in terms of suggesting that Africa's different from the rest of the world and we don't have anything to learn from Africa. Now,
Many film scholars and critics have argued that African filmmaking is the most marginalized regional cinema within the international film scene. And it's true that many Black Africans continue to experience racism and paternalism at these events. But as Bayar again reminds us, there is the danger, I quote, that the vast literature produced by journalists and academics, which refers ad nauseum to the marginalization of Africa, does no more than reproduce Hegel's idea that this part of the globe is an enclave. So in this sense, I have two broad aims in this talk. First of all, I want to use African examples not as some kind of curiosity, but as generative of how we can think about all film forms and film producers who are marginalized in some measure, and what can be done in terms of this marginalization. While Black Africans have certainly suffered tremendous injustices in the world from the days of the Atlantic slave trade through colonialism to today, which has led to the rise of the Black Lives Matter movement you probably know about in the US, they are of course not the only group who's suffered injustices in the world. Along with racism, we have colorism today, sexism, homophobia, xenophobia, ageism, and oppression based on religious intolerance. And I think the entrenching of neoliberal capitalism, as we also have heard about in the previous talk, the entrenching of neoliberal capitalism in many parts of the world has actually led to continued abuses of power, to gross class inequalities, and to the exploitation of millions of people who are trying to survive. Translated into film terms, we can see many examples of this. Just to move away from Africa to the gender issue, we see this really entrenched in terms of gender inequalities in the film industry. The Hollywood actress Gina Davis has been undertaking a big project looking at gender balance in the film industries, and she's found that particularly in the key roles of screenwriter and film director, women make up only a tiny fraction of those roles globally. So that's just one example. So clearly there are many groups who are underrepresented within filmmaking and cultural production, and the activist question thus becomes, what can we all do about this marginalization? And in this talk, I particularly want to look at the relative impact of two solutions to marginalization. First of all, trying to mainstream marginalized films, such as African films, through international film festivals. And on the other hand, trying to give more prominence to marginalized films through specific identity-oriented festivals. And in my case, this of course means African film festivals. Okay, so that's the first broad aim. The second aim is picking up on Bayar in the spirit of not referring ad nauseum to the marginalization of Africa, to really adopt a positive stance and look at the exciting new ventures in the film festival world and the many opportunities that marginalized filmmakers now have access to. Sometimes paradoxically, actually through using their marginalization as what some of the filmmakers have called a USP in marketing terms, a unique selling point. And I'll come back to that later. So this move towards agency is also in keeping with a lot of the work of African scholars in my field who are starting to use terms such as Afro-optimism rather than Afro-pessimism, Afropolitanism, picking up on cosmopolitan discourses, and diaspora-led development. And notably, and you know, what's relevant to all of you being part of the new generation is that I found that a lot of this positive thinking and optimism has come from the younger generation of African filmmakers who are under the age of 40, who have quite a different attitude to their to the older generation. So I think there's a lot of potential in your generation and what you're all doing and how you're approaching the world that I'm trying to learn from in my research. So before I get on to looking at these new examples, though, I think it is important to do a little bit of time travel and go back in history to try and understand where African filmmakers have come from and what these challenges and the marginalization have been. Otherwise, we don't have a sense of what people have gone through. So exactly 50 years ago, in 1966, the first feature film was made by a sub-Saharan African in Africa. And this film is called Le Noir d'Eux, or The Black Girl From... And it was made by the man who came to be known as the father of African cinema, a Senegalese filmmaker called Ousmane Sembène. Has anyone heard of Sembène before? Okay, so you should know about him, and I highly recommend that you try and see this documentary that I've listed at the bottom here, Semben with an exclamation mark. It's a brand new documentary that looks at Semben's fascinating life. I mean, this man, you cannot believe that this man actually became a filmmaker. He came from a very poor fishing family, and his whole career is just extremely inspirational in terms of what he went on to do with his life. The film Le Noir d'Eau is based on a true story that Sembeng came across in a newspaper in France when he was living there about a young Senegalese maid who was taken from Senegal to France by her bosses to work in their home. And in France, she was treated like a slave and actually ended up committing suicide. So it's a very harrowing film, but it's beautiful and very moving, and it's recently been restored on account of its canonical status in film history, not just in African film history. So I just want to show you the YouTube trailer quickly of the film so you get a sense of it. Okay.
J'ai dû arracher les blancs. Est-ce que quelqu'un est venu m'attendre?
Arrivé? Allons-y.
La cuisine, la salle de bain, la chambre à coucher, le salon. Je ne fais que ça. Je ne suis pas venu en France pour ça.
So why did it take so long then for the first feature film to be made in sub-Saharan Africa by an African, you might be wondering? Well, European colonial powers at the time made sure that film technology didn't reach African hands, and certain laws were actually put in place to prevent filmmaking by Africans. So, for example, the French government introduced a law called the Laval Decree in 1934, which established that any African film script had to go through the French government. And as a result, they censored everything, and nothing could be made until the post-independence period in the 1960s. Now, keeping with our topic on film festivals, I wanted to pause briefly on Le Noir d'Eau as a case study of how the early African films were treated at international film festivals. And we find certain interesting paradoxes here. So Le Noir d'Eau was the first African film to ever win a prize at the most prestigious film festival in the world, the Cannes Film Festival. And the prize that it won was the Prix Jean Vigo, which is a prize dedicated annually to a young French filmmaker of independent spirit. So the fact that Semben, a Senegalese filmmaker, won the award for a French filmmaker is symbolic of a consistent French practice of attempting to appropriate certain African filmmakers as their own, which is a remnant of policies of assimilation and francophony from the colonial times. Certain African filmmakers succumbed to this appropriation, but Ousmane Sembène remained fiercely Afrocentric to his last days, and he judged his worth as a filmmaker by his ability to touch audiences in Africa. He used to say that Africa is my audience, and the West and the rest are markets. He was a very forceful figure. I once had the opportunity to do an interview with him and asked him to interpret some of his films, and he just shouted at me. He said, "That's not my job. That's your job. You're the critic. My job is to make films and to make them well." His very last film was called Moulade and was about this very difficult issue of female genital mutilation that happens, you probably know, in certain African countries. Simbin was 80 at the time, and he was in this small village in West Africa making this film and having debates with many of the male elders in the village about how awful this practice was. And he used to not sleep very much. He used to say, you know, I can, when I die, I will sleep. But now while I'm alive, I'm going to work. So he's a very, very interesting, passionate figure. Okay, coming back to the film, it's furthermore paradoxical or perhaps just plain cynical that Le Noir d'Or was awarded the Prix Jean Vigo for French filmmakers when, as you can see from the trailer, what this film was trying to do for the first time was carve out an independent space for Black African expression, something that had never been there, it hadn't existed up until that time. And interestingly, the film was not funded by the Bureau of African Cinema, which had been set up in 1963 in Paris to fund African films. It was funded instead by Simbin's own film production company in co-production with Les Actualités Françaises, which was a French newsreel service based in Senegal. And because of the co-production, Simbin still had to submit the script to the Bureau of African Cinema, and they were absolutely furious about this film. They said, this film is too critical of France, it's directed against us. And Andrés Bobada said to them, no, it's not directed against France, it's expressing the feelings of people who had France imposed on them for many years. So the Bureau rejected the film, but Simbin, being a rebel, went ahead and made it anyway, and the rest is history because it's one of the most important films in film history. Now, Simbin's experiences of marginalization and appropriation of his work on the International Film Festival circuit has been experienced by many other African filmmakers. So you can see, I've done research on how many African films have been screened in the official competition at Cannes or won awards, and it's very, very few, as you can see here. And this is even more paradoxical when you consider that France was the main funder of African cinema for several decades and produced no fewer than 125 of the 185 African short and feature films that were made by 1975. So confronted with this aid, African filmmakers often felt in a very difficult position. They didn't have other funding sources, so they felt they had to take the money, but they often had conditions placed on that funding, like, for example, editors had to be French. And so they didn't feel that they could fully express themselves. And this was obviously a time also before the advent of new digital technologies, which has changed everything in Africa. I'm not going to go into that in this talk, but there's a whole other interesting strand to do with Nollywood, which is the big film industry in Nigeria. Have any of you heard of Nollywood? Okay, it's the second biggest film industry now after Bollywood. But these are very quickly, cheaply made films. They turned around in sort of 2 weeks. People pull in their neighbors to come and act in them. And if you watched them, you would think it was, you know, awful quality, sort of soap opera melodrama. But these films have been really, really popular throughout Africa because they're telling African stories. So we can talk a bit about Nollywood later if you're interested in that. Okay, so anyway, this entire experience of marginalization, appropriation of work by African filmmakers was obviously extremely frustrating for them. For Simbin, he always talked about cinema as a night school for his own people in Senegal. He'd actually started out as a novelist, and then he went to study filmmaking in the Soviet Union. And after that, he traveled all around Africa and visited lots of African countries and found that there was a lot of non-literacy that people couldn't read. And so he turned to the film medium, partly as an educational tool to reach his people. And he really wanted his films to provoke debate, to be screened in kind of festival situations where people could debate them. And often the discussions after his films went on for much longer than the films themselves. So it was on account of these desires that, together with a group of his friends, Simbin started the first African film festival on African territory, the amazing FESPACO Film Festival. This stands for the Pan-African Festival of Cinema and Television of Ouagadougou in the West African country of Burkina Faso. And it was founded in 1969. At this time, no African television stations or cinema theaters in Africa were prioritizing African films. It was really expensive for them to show African films because they hadn't yet recouped costs on the international market. So it was much cheaper to kind of get B-grade Hollywood films that had already made their money and could be dumped very cheaply on other markets around the world. So Simbin and his compatriots decided to take matters in their own hands and create this festival. And it was a platform to allow African films to reach African audiences. And by the third edition of the festival in 1972, the government of Burkina Faso realized how important this festival was. This sort of links to the talk this morning and relative government involvement with festivals. Has anybody been to Burkina Faso? Yes, okay, Imka's been. So it's the UN calls it the fourth poorest country in the world. It is, it's like there's red dust everywhere. Cotton is its only export. So the government saw the potential of a film festival sort of attract tourism and people to come into Ouagadougou. And so the funding support from the government has survived successive coup d'etat and regime changes in Burkina, most recently the deposition of the last president, Blaise Compaoré, in 2014. And this is how it came to be that a country as poor as Burkina Faso has put on one of the most inspirational film festivals in the world for the past 50 years, and how Ouagadougou is the only city in the world that actually has a monument dedicated to its filmmakers in the Place des Cinéastes, which is at the crossroads of two busy streets in Ouagadougou. So most people pass this daily. And I just think this is so beautiful that this poor country has a monument to its filmmakers. You would expect that from Paris, but not from Ouagadougou. The American journalist Kenneth Turan can barely hide his admiration for FESPACO when he writes about it in a book which looks at festivals from Sundance to Sarajevo. He says, in a scenario that even Hollywood would reject as outlandish, FESPACO has managed by a combination of passion and determination to turn itself into the capital of the African film world. Beyond being one of the few spaces that's dedicated to wholeheartedly celebrating African film in the world, what makes FESPACO so different from many other film festivals like the Cannes Film Festival is its openness and accessibility rather than its exclusivity. I have gone to the festival every edition from 2003 to 2013. And just to break away a little bit to tell you about my first visit to the festival, because I'd like to encourage you to go to this festival whenever you can. But I went when I started my PhD on African film, and I'd never been to West Africa. I didn't know anybody there, but I really believe in sort of guerrilla research, just get out there and do it and start learning. But the travel agent I booked my flight to didn't have a clue where Ouagadougou was either, so we got the map out and I had to show her it's this little country, a little city in West Africa. Anyway, so they booked my flight for me, but when I was on my flight, I was going to go into Dakar in Senegal and then get a connecting flight to Ouagadougou. So when I was on my flight down to Senegal, I switched on the flight map and I saw that the plane was headed towards the Bay of Bengal in the Himalayas, not towards the coast of West Africa. So I thought, what the hell is going on here? Are we avoiding some anti-aircraft missiles or what's going on? And then I saw there was a little red flashing dot, Dhaka in Bangladesh. So I had been booked on a flight to Dhaka in Bangladesh instead of Dakar in Senegal. Anyway, I'll save the rest of the story for a beer later. I eventually made it to Ouagadougou. I got rescued by a family there. I have never, on all the following times I went to the festival, I have never had such a good time. But it was a real adventure. Anyway, that's just to encourage you all to do guerrilla research and see that, even if you land in problems like me, you can still get out of it and you learn a lot in the process. So anyway, I love FESPACO. That was my first visit, and I was so stunned by the generosity of the filmmakers, who were really approachable as they sat around drinking beer. You could go up and interview them, which is very, very different from other festivals. They're really relaxed relationships. And unlike many other festivals which open with these fancy gala premieres, which are accessible only to an inner circle of guests, FESPACO opens at the big stadium of the 4th of August, which seats 35,000 people and their fireworks and big musical performances and puppet shows. And this is what makes the festival so popular with local people. They also have clowns on stilts who welcome people when they come to the cinemas. And Burkina, as with many West African countries, is a Muslim, predominantly Muslim country. So you hear the muezzins call to prayer throughout the day. And it's really just a beautiful open atmosphere there. And the festival's openness is also evident in the local public's engagement with it. Tickets to films only cost about 500 CFA, which is less than €1. So the festival's accessible even to the poorest people there. And there also are lots of free screenings in the less central neighborhoods by mobile cinema units that travel around and get local film critics to get people excited about film. Okay, so just to sum up then, the main goals of FESPACO, as with the other African film festivals that have followed it, are first of all to allow Africans to see themselves and their stories on the screen, something that happens very rarely. To allow African filmmakers to exchange ideas and experiences with one another, to consolidate an Africanized perspective on filmmaking, and to allow the building of communities who are African or who care about Africa in the case of African film festivals outside of the continent. So in other words, the goals have been representational and changing the kind of films we see on our screens and also community-based in terms of allowing African filmmakers and audiences to network and connect with one another. Unfortunately, FESPACO is currently undergoing a lot of organizational problems, but it, on the whole, it has been very successful in achieving these goals and really has defined what African cinema is for many people. And just a few, I'm not very big on quantitative stuff, I'm much more of a qualitative person, but if we do look at some of the numbers in economic terms, you can see that the success is based, is backed up also by the numbers. So the audience numbers at FESPACO, it started with 10,000 people in 1969, that grew to 100,000 in 1979, and by 2009, there were 500,000 participants, so that's really huge. And in 1989, the FESPACO commissioned the University of Ouagadougou to research the festival's economic impact, and this was found to be 700 million CFA, which was double the festival's entire budget for that year. So you can really see, you know, festivals have a huge economic impact, obviously, on the cities in which they take place. And this trickles down even to the poorest people. In a lot of my research, I like to walk the streets wherever I go. So I walk the streets, I talk to SIM card sellers, to cab drivers, and ask them what the festival's impact was for them. And they found that it hugely increased their salaries for, you know, the month in which FESPACO took place, and actually subsidized, you know, their annual costs for the, you know, for the rest of the year. Okay, so that's a brief look at the history then, the way that African films have been marginalized at Cannes, at the world's most prestigious film festival, and why there was a need to create an African film festival on African territory. I want to sort of move up to the present now and just give you a snapshot of some of the other festivals that have followed. So here is just a selection of some of the African film, many African film festivals that now take place in the world. You're probably saying here, oh, I said that FESPACO was the first African film festival. In fact, that was a bit of a lie. It's not. There was a film festival in Tunisia that started a few years before, but FESPACO is much, much more important. But they are sister festivals now, so they happen in alternate years. And what you then see is 15 years after FESPACO started, you get African film festivals all over the rest of the world outside the continent growing. So in Canada, in LA, in New York, Sweden, the Cambridge Festival, African Film Festival, is the first one that I founded, and then Barbados, Spain, Scotland, South America. And then in the last decade, you see a growth again of African film festivals on the African continent in places like Namibia, Egypt, Tanzania, and Ethiopia. Now, in keeping with the theme of internationalization for the symposium, you see international dimensions to all of these festivals, but they have explicitly focused, of course, on screening African films. There's also, however, been a rapid proliferation of international film festivals on the African continent in the last sort of two decades, from the late 1990s. As you can see here, there were a couple of festivals on the continent that had an international dimension from the early years. So an incredible festival of amateur film in Kilibia in Tunisia in the 1960s, and then festivals in Egypt and South Africa in the 1970s. But this wave of international festivals really begins from the late 1990s onwards, and you can see how diverse the African countries are in which these take place. Now, it's very important to note that this proliferation of festivals is not confined to Africa. It's part of a global phenomenon of festivalization. There are an estimated 3,500 film festivals globally every year, and that isn't even including all the other kinds of arts and cultural festivals. Now, scholars have approached this festivalization in two ways. Some see it as a symptom of a global situation that is privileging the spectacularization of culture, and at the same time marginalizing all forms of alternative culture from the mainstream. and others see it as an example of resistance to the status quo and to the marginalization of certain forms of culture. So you've got the positive and the negative interpretation of what's going on. In other words, scholars are asking, is this phenomenon of festivalization a symptom of a neoliberal capitalist world that will tolerate the visibility of certain kinds of culture only on the margins, not on the mainstream? Because, of course, festivals are rare events. They're not part of everyday culture. They happen, you know, for a short period of time once a year. So is this a way of pushing these forms of culture actually to the margins? Or is festivalization a sign that actually a certain kind of democratization of culture is happening, and also a certain kind of resistance to our digital era? And I'll come back to that question later. It's really difficult to start answering these questions in an abstract way. I think we can only answer them through the slow, dedicated work of considering individual case studies and examples. So I'd like to move briefly from this, you know, more abstract theoretical work to the very personal, and reflect briefly on my own reasons for feeling that it was really important to co-found the UK's first annual African Film Festival, the Cambridge African Film Festival, in 2001, and then the Film Africa Festival in London in 2011. As a child, I grew up in a family of white anti-apartheid activists in the apartheid and then the post-apartheid period in South Africa. So I grew up with a constant sense of the marginalization of the majority of the population in my country and the extreme oppression that they had, that they suffered. When I moved to the UK then as a young adult in 2001, to start a PhD on African cinema, I became aware of how the images of Africa and the narratives of Africa in the mainstream media in Europe didn't cohere at all with my experiences of what it meant to live in Africa. I found the dominant discourses were extremely negative. So the festival for me was a way of trying to challenge those discourses. And then I also found that whenever I told people about the films that I was studying, nobody had ever seen them. So I thought, I can't just sit, you know, writing in a university library about these films that nobody can see. So I really felt it was important to get out there and do something and try and make these films accessible. So this was really a very embodied and emotional response to the situation that I found myself in. And I found that that's a shared response of many people who have founded identity-based film festivals of one kind or another, whether these are women's film festivals or LGBTI festivals or black film festivals or other kinds of festivals, which are all partly activist events that have similar representational and community goals. So just to sum, those are the images from my festivals, which I'll talk about in the afternoon session. So the aims of these festivals in general, by or for marginalized groups, are first of all representational. So they aim to challenge and replace negative and singular narratives with more positive and diverse narratives. And they aim to create especially live communities to share knowledge and experiences, and in this way fortify themselves against their marginalization. And again, I don't have the time to go into it now, but we can talk about it this afternoon again. But this idea of liveness, of coming together face to face, has been so key in the way that festivals have been theorized, particularly in this digital world we're living in, where people increasingly are watching films in the space of their own homes. Some of the most inspirational examples for me that sort of expand beyond African examples of these festivals that focus on marginalized groups are the Fisahara Festival in Algeria. This was the most exciting festival that I went to in my research. And again, I really encourage you to go. It happens in the Sahrawi refugee camps in southern Algeria. It's where people have been living in refugee camps for over 40 years now. And together with international activists, they've created this film festival that's been running for about 12 years. And you go and you live with the people in their khaimas. So it's the only festival I know of where you actually, it's a festival of cohabitation, where you live with the local community. And then you watch films under the stars every night in the Sahara Desert and talk to people. And, you know, it's an activist event. And then some of the others I don't have the time to talk about, but the Migrant Workers Film Festival in South Korea, Side by Side, which is an amazing LGBTI festival in Russia that continuously comes under harassment from the government. The Slum Film Festival, which happens in two slums in Kenya, and which is designed to try and support the poorest people in the world and making films and getting them seen. And then the International Images of Women Film Festival in Zimbabwe, where they screen films about women's issues from all over the world, and they get the Zimbabwean women to watch these films and decide from them what they want to maintain from their own culture and what they feel inspired by from the other films to change. Okay, so these rather small and battle film festivals occupy the lowest rung on the pecking order of film festivals, and they're sometimes accused of ghettoizing the films that they screen into these categories of race and class and so forth. And these critics argue that, in fact, the way forward should be trying to get marginalized filmmakers into the A-list international film festivals. Now, there's always a lot of debate about which are the best film festivals in the world, but generally it comes back to what are called the big five, which are the first five on this list, Venice, Cannes, Locarno, Berlin, and Rotterdam, all in Europe. Then the big American film festivals, which started in the 1970s, Toronto and Sundance. Some of the big documentary festivals like IDFA in Amsterdam. And then you've seen a growth of very important film festivals in Asia and in the Middle East in the last two decades. So, for example, the Busan Film Festival in South Korea and Dubai in the Middle East in the year 2000. So for the purposes of my talk, I'm interested in asking whether we can consider these festivals as also responding to forms of marginalization in film culture, even if they're not screening films by marginalized groups like, you know, Black filmmakers, LGBTI filmmakers, and so forth. We have to remember here that the inspiration to create the first film festivals in the world in the early 1930s was to challenge Hollywood's dominance over filmmaking. It was no accident that all five of those big five festivals started in Europe. These events were a central part of what were known as the film wars that attempted to protect the European film industries from the American juggernaut. So in this respect, even the most powerful film festivals have established themselves through a sense of being marginalized and attempting to challenge the status quo. And we also have to remember then that a potent criterion within film festivals' curatorial processes from the mid-1960s onwards has been the idea of discovery. Most festivals' existence is founded on the desire to screen films that, for whatever reason, would not be shown in a particular context. So the most logical definition of festival cinema then is, in the most fundamental economic sense, films that have not had or are unlikely to have a mainstream market. And there's opportunity here for all independent filmmakers. New stories and visions are constantly needed by the festival circuit. And there's some really inspirational examples of films that have been validated by film festivals and then gone on to achieve major symbolic victories for regions and people. Just have a look. Have any of you been to any of these A-list film festivals? Okay. There is for Cannes, some people think it's impossible to get into Cannes, but there is a cinephile pass that you can get and go to the festival. So that's quite a nice way to actually get to Cannes and experience it. Okay, acknowledging the role that all film festivals are playing in addressing the problem of distribution for marginalized cinemas, Dina Yordanova notes that there seems to be a growing consensus on festivals as an alternative distribution network for world cinema beyond Hollywood, in a context in which, as I'm sure you find here too, there's been a rise of multiplex cinemas and mainstream programming, and it's becoming more and more difficult for people to watch alternative films of any kind in public settings with a live audience. Okay. Now, it's important, just coming back to the economic issues, to mention here that no matter how large and successful a film festival is, festivals can't run as for-profit organizations. Even these big, very successful festivals can only survive through a mixture of public funding, corporate sponsorship, and box office returns and accreditation. So most of the world's 3,500 film festivals have to be thoroughly subsidized to survive. So there's a lot of anxiety about around the claims about the value of film festivals in general. And Marijke de Walt talks about this in the very first book on film festivals. which was published in 2007. She asks, does the festival network offer a safe environment for the vulnerable films in our society where they can be sheltered from commercial interests and be appreciated on their own cultural and artistic terms? Or does it merely provide a pseudo-cure that allows filmmakers to remain marginal by sinking deeper and deeper into the secluded festival network and losing their ability to connect to the film world outside? And then beyond this, many marginalized filmmakers complain that even if their films are selected at these film festivals, they end up being lost because of the inner hierarchies within them. So what happens is that marginalized regions like the Middle East or Africa just don't have the funding to support filmmakers with the press teams, with the marketing teams that you have to send with films when they go to the festivals to move them beyond just having a single screening in the festival to getting into mainstream distribution. So the main issue that has been circling in African filmmaking discussions today, as in the 1960s, comes down to distribution, which is the key to ensuring that African and non-African audiences see African films, and importantly to monetizing African creativity in the local and global audiovisual industries. Because, let's face it, filmmakers have to earn money to be able to make their next films. So I've tried in a practical way to try and address some of these issues through the creation of what was called the African Film Distribution Forum at my Film Africa Festival in London, to which we invited many of the new generation of African filmmakers who are making waves. And we wanted to focus on the moment at which the dreams of many filmmakers fall apart, and that is after they've made their films. And we wanted to explore in particular why mainstream internationally oriented distributors and sales agents were overlooking so many powerful films, and why these films, even when they were given releases, were not reaching large audiences. I was very interested that realism in relation to the global commercial film market was the overwhelming tone at each of the distribution forums. Far from criticizing film festivals, the new generation of younger African filmmakers expressed a desire to work with the festivals rather than against them. Their attitude reveals far less suspicion about, you know, potential neo-colonial paternalism at festivals outside of Africa, and a great deal more openness to the fickleness and vagaries of the international audiovisual industries. Many of them are not interested in blaming the A-list festivals and the mainstream distributors for their difficulties and are taking responsibility for their own fate. For example, the Zimbabwean filmmaker Tendeka Mutatu said at the 2011 African Film Distribution Forum, "Filmmakers have to be realistic about who their audiences are, and we have to be realistic as African filmmakers that the mass market is not our market, but there is an audience for our films, and it's a niche audience. We just have to be very clever about how we reach that audience. The big distributors aren't going to buy our films because it costs them way too much money and way too much time. So we really have to think outside of the box to sell our films. And we need to realize that theatrical release isn't the be-all and the end-all of distribution. For a lot of films, all you need is to get the films in the cinemas for 1 week. You get the publicity, you get the reviews in the papers, and then the film is available through other platforms." So Mutatu really encouraged marginalized filmmakers to try to identify their primary audiences and then do everything that they can to target those audiences, particularly through self-distribution through online forums such as Dynamo, Player, and Vimeo. And there are quite a few examples now of filmmakers who are getting recognized from by film festivals after putting their own content up online. For example, the Rwandese German filmmaker Emilia Umuhire, who started her own online web series called Polyglot. It's available online for free if you're interested in looking at it. It's absolutely beautiful. Cecile Emeka, who's a British filmmaker who started several online web series like Strolling and Aki and Saltfish. And the young Moroccan filmmaker Nadia Boumouche, who made a film that was very critical of the Moroccan government, My Maxin and Me, put it up online. It went viral amongst young Moroccans. As a result, he can't really go back into Morocco, so he can't live in his country. So there were quite big stakes for making that film, but very inspirational. Then you also have people like the Zambian filmmaker Rungano Nyoni, who believes so much in the power of film festivals to support independent filmmaking that she started a company called My Festival Office, which submits films to festivals for filmmakers. It helps them to identify the right kind of festival for their film. You may have heard of companies like Without a Box and Film Freeway that sort of play this role in a very big corporate sense, but this is a kind of boutique version of that. And she supports the idea that filmmakers need to take charge of their own destinies and says, lots of filmmakers spend lots of time and energy making their films, and what they don't realize is you have to spend as much time distributing them. And she argues that festivals will in fact be the only form of theatrical distribution that many filmmakers enjoy, and that filmmakers have to make the most of that opportunity of festivals, which is the ability to show one's film in lots of different territories all over the world, to gauge audience reactions in different territories to your film, to create buzz and a fan base, and only in very rare cases to find a distributor or sales agent who's willing to take on your film. So she earmarks festivals like Berlin, like South by Southwest, Cannes, Seattle, Tribeca, the Los Angeles Film Festival, and Toronto and Telluride is what she calls super festivals that can guarantee success for a film. But she's very philosophical about them as well, and she said, don't be deterred if your film doesn't get into any of these super festivals, because they're very competitive and sometimes they don't know what they're talking about. Because the film Amelie, I don't know if anyone's seen the film Amelie, she says that that actually got rejected at Cannes, and then they said it was dull and uninteresting, and it went on to be one of the most successful French films of all time. So I thought that was really inspirational. The feminist theorist Rosie Bridgetti notes that in the current world order, I quote, the so-called flexibility or precariousness of actual work conditions makes for social instability, transitory citizens, and impermanent settlements. While there are, of course, big differences across distinct places, cities, and regions that we can't ignore, perhaps it is the younger generation who has grown up in this context of new global precarity who's better equipped to deal with it. And I think this is particularly the case in Africa, where a huge percentage of the African population, about 70%, is under the age of 30. So Africa is a young continent, and young people are having to face these very precarious working situations and find solutions to them. The younger generation of filmmakers from Africa is also far more flexible and strategic when it comes to this idea of being marginal because you're African. Nioni argues that Africanness can sometimes be a disadvantage if you come from a country with very poor infrastructure for film, like Zambia, but you can also specifically use that, she says, as your USP, as your unique selling point. And she really praises the specialized African film festivals for being much more intimate than the large international film festivals and for putting the entire focus on promoting African filmmakers. So, for example, when she came to Al Film Festival Film Africa in London, she got to be part of a press junket for the first time. She was interviewed by CNN, by the BBC, and she said she really felt that that helped her to get a very prestigious BAFTA nomination for her short film, and she said that wouldn't have happened at one of the big international film festivals. The South African filmmaker Sarah Bletcher reflects here in an interview I did with her also on the differences between the big international film festivals and the smaller African film festivals after her film Othello Burning played at 70 film festivals around the world. She says, to be absolutely honest, the African Film Festival is better than the London Film Festival because the African Film Festival gets real attention for African films, whereas at the London Film Festival, you're lost. London is so prestigious. When people say, oh, what festivals did your film play at? I mentioned the London Film Festival, not the African Film Festival. But in terms of actually helping the film, it's completely the other way around. And to me, African film festivals are so critical for filmmakers dialoguing with one another. When I started traveling with Othello to African film festivals, I had no idea what was going on in the rest of the African continent. We don't see those films. We don't hear about those films. We don't meet those people. However, after traveling the international circuit with her films and seeing them move thousands of people, Bletcher says, the thing I've realized is that there are so many audiences and reaching them is so difficult, and nobody has worked out how to reach those audiences in an organized way that actually makes money, and that's the challenge. The challenge is how to get these films that people are incredibly moved by to make money to go back to the filmmakers. So she says that something's really not working in the model we keep trying, and a new model is required. The model she advocates for is a trending one that makes the film simultaneously available across a range of different platforms in any territory, physical, broadcast, and online, and uses all of these platforms and their associated publicity to create buzz around the film. At the same time, Bletcher says, while you pursue your domestic strategy, you shouldn't ignore your global release strategy. And she says that this is where festivals come into the picture. You have to just think of the festivals as branching out and entering other countries. The festivals are ways of getting seen in other places. And she speaks in equally excited tones about traveling to the Busan Film Festival in South Korea, as she does about the fact that Othello Burning is now available on a range of digital platforms, particularly through the support of the Sundance Institute's Artists Services Program. She says the experience of actually being in Busan in South Korea and feeling the excitement of the audience, rather than hearing about the screening afterwards or conducting a Skype Q&A with the audience with all the problems of connectivity, clearly had a real charm and value for her. She says when you actually go to the festivals, when you see the touching your film is doing, when your film is on at the cinema, you have no idea what people are saying or thinking about it. You read the reviews, but that's so far removed from people's actual experience of it. Another African filmmaker who's experimenting with new models is the Nigerian filmmaker Obi Emilonya. He's working in a kind of reverse way to Sara Bletcher. With his film, The Messenger, he started with a physical screening in London rather than in Lagos, in Nigeria. But this physical screening was simultaneously accompanied by a Google Hangout, and then also the screening of the film on three online platforms specifically for African films, Iroko, Afrinali, and Ibaka. And the film then went on to physically play in cinemas in Lagos. Now, it has to be emphasized that due to the constraints of physical screenings, the digital sphere offers, obviously, potentially much larger audiences. Bletcher's film, Othello Burning, barely attracted an audience to South African cinemas, but when it screened on a private TV channel, Mnet, in South Africa, she had 1 million viewers. And similarly, Obi Emilonya's film, Last Flight to Abuja, didn't attract a big cinema audience, but it had 1.5 million views on YouTube. So the question remains what economic capital these digital opportunities will bring to filmmakers in a global context of shadow film economies, rampant piracy, and low digital licensing fees. So in conclusion then, I think all marginalized filmmakers have to move with the times if they're going to survive in an increasingly competitive and dynamic global audiovisual marketplace. All strategies, the domestic and the international, the festival and the digital strategies, should run in parallel, since you can never be sure what the outcome is going to be. And if you did, perhaps some of the magic of being a filmmaker would also disappear. I think it is possible, however, to argue with confidence that the rise of new digital platforms for film is not likely to bring about the death of film festivals. According to Philip Natchbull, who's the CEO of Cosin Cinemas in the UK, which runs the very important distribution company Artificial Eye, and also runs the VOD platform Cosin On Demand, he says, we think for an independent art house cinema, the communal experience, the immersive experience, people who really care about cinema, that's all still going to exist. We've seen the coming of television, the coming of VHS, all these things that were going to spell the death knell of cinema, and we just don't believe that video on demand is going to do that either. We think a cinema has something special to offer. So African film festivals are really taking strength in these predictions and in community. Verena was talking earlier about the fact that it's not so much money but collaboration that is really needed. And one sees this in terms of recent initiatives with African film festivals. There's a network that's been created on the continent called AfriFestNet that connects all kinds of arts and cultural festivals. You can find that online if you just look up AfriFestNet. And then there has been outside the continent an initiative called the Africa Vision Exchange, which is designed to create networks of African film festivals outside the continent. And we have that going in the UK at the moment with the 5 African film festivals that run there. If these initiatives work, they will result in the strengthening of a circuit of film festivals that care about African cinema, and they will complement the new VOD and digital platforms for African film like Iroko, Buni TV, and AfricaFilms.tv. But ultimately, I think all projects in support of marginalized filmmakers need to actually work towards their own extinction, towards a time, however utopian, in which marginalized filmmakers are not treated as a curiosity, not even spoken about as marginalized, but appreciated on their own specific individual terms and not under the generalizing, ghettoizing rubric of the African or the Black or the female or the LGBTI umbrella. Thank you very much for your patience. Oh, yes, that was very long. Thanks.